Copy 724, roger. Send and maintain 2000.
Send and maintain 2000, 74.
Send and maintain
504 to send and maintain 3000.
Tonight on Afterburn, Hammy has a thing for James Bond. I do something. And Tilt has thoughts on Libya. Listen to the howl and roar. Man of attention, begging you to touch and go. Hello and welcome to Afterburn, the only show that annoys the crap out of you with magical ponies. I'm Drake, and I'm joined by my co-host Hammy, who kills beavers. With us tonight is the terror of the Northern Territories, Tilt.
Hey guys. We're going to open the show with James Bond. Now the 60s was a wonderful time. Bad music, hippies, and of course, From Russia With Love.
Bond. James Bond.
Most people consider Sean Connery to be the only true Bond. While I am a big fan of Sean Connery as James Bond, I have to say he's not my favorite.
Come on.
Well, what do you mean?
He pitch slaps girls. He's awesome.
Well, I mean, he was the smoker, the drinker, you know, he basically epitomized James Bond, but just as far as his stories and his character development and everything, I'm going to have to say Daniel Craig is probably my favorite Bond.
No. He's cool. He is very cool, but he is not quite the right James Bond, not to mention the fact that he's blonde.
Well, in the original novels, James Bond was blonde.
No, he wasn't.
Yes, he was.
No, he wasn't. He had black hair.
Yeah, they remember talking about that. Atari was telling me about that a while back. He said the original James Bond stories, James Bond was a blonde guy.
So wait, which one do you like? The new James Bond?
Yeah.
That guy's kind of gay. He's like
hairy. Well, see, when I first started watching Casino Royale, my thought was, this guy's not James Bond. He's Race Bannon.
Just let me throw a barrel at it.
You know, the blonde hair, the dirty look. He needs an assault rifle and fatigues, not a pistol and a tuxedo.
So in other words, he is completely wrong to be James Bond.
Well, see, that's what I thought. That's what I thought for the whole first half of the movie. But then as I watched it, I'm like, this explains how James Bond became who he is. How the card game, this woman, everything that he is, being in that sophisticated lifestyle, turned him into the suave spy that we know him as now, not just the grungy jungle running through construction sites Bond that he was.
Well, I like him being James Bond the same way that I like what's-his-name being Batman.
Christian Bale?
Yeah, because that's sort of a new, gritty, kind of vaguely realistic Batman. And that kind of works because all the old Batmans were kind of cartoony. And all the old James Bonds were sort of very stereotypical James Bond. Of them, my two favorites have probably got to be Pierce Brosnan and Sean Connery. And Sean Connery was just the best one because he was Sean Connery.
But he was a Scot, not a Brit.
Yeah, but when you think most interesting man in the world, who do you think of?
Sean Connery.
And when you think of the James Bond character or actor having that resemblance, it's going to be Sean Connery. Because none of these other guys, you can't see them cooking in the kitchen in Cougar.
But I just look at the evolution of James Bond, and I feel sorry for George Lazenby because he was between two Connery Bonds, and people were not open to the idea of a different man playing Bond.
This never happened to the other fella.
So while George Lazenby did a good job, and he was stuck with a bad story and a bad director, he just got screwed. Now, the person after Bond was the worst Bond, which was Roger Moore.
Well, Roger Moore, yeah, he was bad, but George, or Lazenby,
yeah.
He has the problem that he looks, acts, and talks like a classic British bad guy. So you can't imagine him being a good guy because he's a bad guy.
Well, the thing with that, though, is they tried too hard to show, look at him, he's exactly like Connery. You see him put the smoke in his mouth, they're hiding from the nose down, from the eyebrows up, and when he first opens up in the fight scene on the beach, you don't see his face. And then the last thing, he breaks the fourth wall, looks right at the camera and goes, oh, I'll bet this didn't happen to the other guy.
This never happened to the other fella.
It's not even that. It's just that he's sort of like Jeremy Irons. He cannot be a good guy. It's not allowed. It's not legal.
Well, I mean, of course, you know, Scar from The Lion King can't be a good guy. But, you know, it's still, if you move on, like, George Lazenby, I think, just got screwed. Roger Moore was just a pompous ass, and he was not the cool asshole like James Bud Connery was. He was just stuck up and pompous. I didn't like Roger Moore at all.
Well, actually, Captain, I'm with the British Secret Service. The name is Bond. James Bond.
Well, nobody likes Roger Moore.
But he had more Bond movies than any other actor, which tells you about society at the time.
I guess, well, I guess for the late 70s into the 80s, he was kind of, the pretty boy at the time. I don't know what the logic to put behind that man is.
But I've seen other movies with Roger Moore, and like Wild Geese when he played a mercenary and everything else. If I was a producer and you told me you wanted Roger Moore to play Bond, I'd have been like, hell yeah, let's get him. But he just did not pull it off.
I forget what movie it is. It's one of the, cross-country racing movies, one of the silly ones. I think it's Cannonball Run. I love it when he plays himself as a guy playing in a spy. He's basically playing a guy playing a spy, and it's hilarious.
But, Roger Moore, not to demean Moore himself. He's a great actor. Folks, Wild Geese. He plays a great mercenary and a great badass. He just did not pull off Bond. Now, who was right after Moore? Was it Dalton, or was there somebody between Dalton and Moore?
I honestly don't. I don't know the order the movies came out in because I'm not that much of a James Bond fan.
I was going to say, because I think Timothy Dalton came next. And originally, they were going to cast Pierce Brosnan, but he was stuck on that TV show. And they killed off his character. And then the producers of that TV show heard that, oh my God, they're interested in him being James Bond. We don't want to lose Pierce Brosnan. So they brought Brosnan back on the show in a really stupid manner, and it killed the TV show, and it killed Pierce Brosnan's chances of playing Bond. And then Timothy Dalton jumped in on it, and he was a dark Bond. He was like he was the real gritty Bond at the time with his two movies he did. And he did a really good job, but he finished up the novels and everything, and they pretty much let the franchise die. Many years later, they did GoldenEye. And the first two Brosnan Bond movies were good.
I like how James Bond sort of did the same thing that MASH did, where they would have a character on in one of the earlier movies, like the big fat general guy, who later on becomes James Bond's like best friend from the CIA.
Oh yeah, you're talking Felix Leiter.
Yeah,
yes.
I think it was Felix.
He was the one that on License to Kill. Was License to Kill or View to Kill? Whichever one, the last Timothy Dalton Bond movie was. He was out for revenge because he was the best man at Felix's wedding, and they killed his wife, and Felix got eaten, half eaten by a shark, and that really pissed Bond off, and he went all dark and killer and everything. But the franchise died at that point, and then many years later, me growing up had never even heard of James Bond, and the first Bond movie I ever saw was GoldenEye, and I really liked Pierce Brosnan.
How was GoldenEye the first James Bond movie you'd ever seen?
Because, I was never into it. My parents...
When you're 10 years old, you're not watching James Bond. But when
I was watching
N64 comes out, and it's got GoldenEye. Or shit, I gotta watch this movie.
Well, I saw it in theaters with my parents, but...
I think the first Bond movie I remember specifically seeing was Goldfinger.
Is that the one with the Asian guy that throws a hat?
Yes.
Yeah, Odd Job.
That guy, he's in jail. He kidnapped a girl and harbored her. And he was... I swear to God, she was his sex slave.
Wow.
Yeah,
so he was right for a villain.
Look up his mugshot. His name.
But
wow.
But then the Pierce Brosnan Bond movies got just as ridiculous as the Roger Moore Bond movies did.
Yeah, that was a big problem. The writing on those sort of slacked off because GoldenEye was really good, and then they followed up with a bunch of really bad.
Well, the second one with Michelle Yeoh, Tomorrow Never Dies, that was actually a pretty good Bond movie too. But after that, they just collided. And finally, the last one he did. A Die Another Day. That was just terrible.
I do like how in Tomorrow Never Dies, they feature very heavily the stealth boat. And it was kind of like, yeah, hey, U.S. Navy, you know that stealth boat thing that you came up with for no good reason? Can we borrow that for a little while? Yeah, okay.
But anyway, and then the franchise once again died. And then they brought Daniel Craig in. And he redid Bond. And I just love Daniel Craig as Bond.
He's too metrosexual. That's why Sean Connery was a fan.
Well, see, the reason I actually have to disagree with that because he wasn't. He was Hawaiian shirt, ratty slacks, messed up wife beater, covered in dirt, chasing this guy through a construction site, by the way, was the inventor of free running for you history buffs.
You know who would have been a good James Bond had they gotten him younger?
Eric Bana.
Who's Eric Bana?
Hector from the movie Troy.
Regis Philbin.
No. He played the Delta Force operator in Black Hawk Down. He was the Jew who was killing this. He was this Jew that was killing those people in that movie Munich.
Okay.
Anyway, who's on your mind?
Sam Neill.
Sam Neill. He needs to be in less bad movies.
He needs to be in more bad movies. Namely, he needs to be in James Bond movies, which are all bad.
Well, now he'd be a good Bond villain.
He would be a good Bond villain, but I think if they had gotten him just a little bit younger, like back in the maybe like late 80s.
At the time of Jurassic
90s.
Park? A little bit before Jurassic Park?
A little bit before that, because even by then he was starting to get that like old...
Hunt for October time?
Yeah, around like the late 80s, maybe mid 80s. Sam Neill would have been a great James Bond, I think.
This is what pisses me off about GoldenEye. That's the one where they have L-39 scene?
No, that was The World Is Not Enough.
It's a Pierce Brosnan.
Yeah, that's the one where he takes off in the mountains with the L-39s.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. First of all, I'm assuming that was like a Russian base. I don't remember.
It was a trafficking base. So
it was in the Alps.
Yeah.
How under budget are they? Their attack aircraft for L-39s.
Well, they use L-39s in every movie.
That's the thing I can't figure out
that's just Hollywood though, because you know they can't get like a MiG-29 or something, so they're just gonna. I mean, for me, that kind of ruins the movie to see an L-39 in the Alps.
What's the thing? You know that there are people who privately own certain Soviet fighter jets. Why not just borrow them?
I know. There's two SU-27s in the United States.
Yeah, and even back in, when was that made? In the late 90s?
Mid to late 90s, yeah.
Yeah. Even by then, if you're going to pick something, I know there are several MiG-21s in the United States.
MiG-21s would have been better.
I know there are several MiG-29s in the United States. Anything would have been better than a trainer.
Yeah.
But L-39s are everywhere, and you can haggle down a great price on L-39s. Some of these guys, just to get their plane in a movie, would probably do it just for the cost of the fuel burn.
Oh, yeah.
And L-39s are everywhere, and they're also supposed to be the most economical jet of that type you can own. That's what I hear, anyway.
Yeah. I don't know. It was just, like, kind of, okay, these guys are supposed to be terrorists, and they have nuclear bombs, or whatever they have.
Nuclear torpedo.
But then they've got an L-39. It's like, dude, oh my...
Well, you even see aircraft for sale in, you know, things like
Trade Plane
and
Barstars.
Yeah. I remember in there I actually saw an ad for a lot, not one, a lot of something like 8 or 9 Hind helicopters. And it's like you can buy so much military surplus and all this nonsense for not very much money. Why don't they just find somebody with a jet and borrow it?
I don't think they really care.
Well, that's
like, because to the general public, too, they don't know that. It's a Soviet design, so like, oh, hey, look, it's a Russian airplane.
Yeah.
No, I mean, we're all pilots here, so we see that and be like, oh, we call BS, but...
See, like, in Blood Diamond, they did it the right way. They actually had a real Hind flying around. And you'll find Hinds in South Africa, so...
Yeah.
What killed me about that scene above all else is I was willing to let the L-39 thing go. Because, hey, these guys are arms dealers. It's easy to throw down an L-39, but... It's the fact that James Bond had an ejection switch for the back seat.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure L-39s don't have ejection seats.
Even if they do, it's not going to be a switch you can just flip. Yeah. They're these big, hard-to-pull handles on purpose, so you don't accidentally fire a seat.
Hey, Rio, guess what?
you slept with my wife. Click. Bye.
Hey, Wizzo, guess what?
Anyway, but... So... I don't know. I have to argue that Daniel Craig is probably my favorite. Daniel Craig is my favorite. I probably have to argue that he's the best. That and Sean Connery just does not look right without a beard.
Nah, Sean Connery when he was younger looked alright without a beard.
I remember watching him in The Bridge Too Far and he had just that little pencil mustache. I'm just like, that just does not look good. Sean Connery.
Sean Connery's actually pretty good at being an action hero. Even when he's old, he's good at being an action hero. Like in The Rock, you know, he's like in there.
Welcome to The Rock.
News are fucked. It's like, that's news are talking. Winners
go home and fuck the prom queen. Yo, bash. Losers go home and whine about their best. Winners go home and fuck the prom queen. Carla was the prom queen. Anyway.
Wow.
Awesome.
So, enough about James Bond.
Alright, I guess we'll talk about Olivia now. Until guest host, and I was just going to ask these guys what their opinions are on the operations in Olivia. Specifically, were we just in going in there, and if we were, did we do it enough?
We're probably not actually just to go in there, just because, to an extent, it's not really our business. A lot of what goes on in the Middle East isn't really our business. but it's sort of the kind of thing where it becomes our business once it spills over the shores of the Middle East. So a little bit of it's preemptive, but a lot of the problem is, I'm sure the people of the State Department know more about this than any of us do, but a lot of us are left scratching our heads going, who exactly are these rebels? Who are we helping out this time? Because it seems like every time we help the rebel faction over there, it just comes back to bite us 10 years later. Like, we helped Saddam get into power, and then we got into a fight with them. We helped the
Afghanis.
Yeah, what do we call the Mujahideen? We helped the Mujahideen, and then that came back to bite us. So, you know, a lot of us are left scratching our heads going, who are these Libyan rebels? And in 10 or 20 years, are they going to come back and be like, oh, hi, America, you helped us fight the revolution, and guess what? We're going to come mess around with you now.
My thing is now, ever since President Obama offered relief aid to the Palestinians, I question his loyalty to any other country. Because by offering the relief aid to the Palestinians against Israel, that would be like helping the Nazis during the Battle of Britain. So ever since he offered that, I pretty much am just against helping whoever he wants to help. Now, I know it's kind of an ignorant comment, but I just don't trust the guy, and I don't trust his choice in friends.
I think what we did in Libya was, I think it was just the right amount of help. Because pretty much what we did was, we took out their air defense capabilities, we took out their tanks, their armor and all that stuff, artillery pieces, and then we kind of just said, all right, guys, you guys were the ones that wanted this fight, you guys were the ones that started protesting the government, so... You know, we did the first part for you, now go do what you wanted to do. And I think my whole problem, I have a really big problem with all these protesters. They're going to cry that, oh my God, they're shooting innocent civilian protesters. All right, if you're living under a regime that's going to bring up fucking guns to your protests, and they're going to ask you to stop protesting or else they're going to start shooting people, if you don't stop, they're going to shoot you, and now you cry wolf. Well, you just shouldn't have done that. I don't know. I guess...
Well, I mean,
it's just like, you guys got what the fuck you wanted, and now you're crying about it.
Well, I think, I haven't heard much out of Libya lately, because, you know, I don't get a lot of news out here, but I do think we did about the right amount of help, because we just lobbed some cruise missiles at them, took out some strategic targets, basically just leveled the playing field for the rebels. As far as any of the protesters over there getting shot at, I haven't heard anything about them complaining about it, but I haven't heard anything at all lately.
Well...
So if they are complaining about it, it's kind of like, what do you think was
going to
happen with your totalitarian regime?
You know, after Libya, all these countries saw that, oh my God, they're getting aid from the United States and England and Canada's here and France is flying around. And then you got Syria, all these people in Syria, oh, we don't like our country either, we're going to start protesting. And what does the government do? It says, guys, cut this shit out. No, we don't like you. All right, guys, here's the tear gas. Well, fine, we're going to throw rocks at you. Don't throw rocks at armed guards. And then these guys got to defend. I mean, yeah, they're bad regimes and all this shit, but if you throw a rock at a Marine, eventually someone's going to start shooting.
Well, there's a little thing called the Boston Massacre that happened in the American colonies just before the Revolutionary War, where these Americans were throwing rocks and sticks and rope and shit at the British soldiers. So what did the Brits do? They shot them.
Yeah, I mean, what do you expect?
Well, to an extent... It's actually useful in igniting a revolution to have some protesters get shot. I know that sounds awful, but it is actually kind of useful because it ignites the fury in the local populace going, okay, well, we sent out some protesters because we don't like what's going on, and then they shot them, what the hell, and then it starts things moving. Now, with the Middle East, in some ways it's hopeful and in some ways it's scary because a lot of the Middle Eastern countries right now are sort of getting into that rebellion status. And it's hopeful in that maybe there's some people there who want to sort of live a normal life under a normal sort of democratic government, which would be nice if that's what all those rebels want. The problem is that being the Middle East, a lot of those rebels in some of those countries may be even more fanatical than the governments that are already in place, and you could end up with a worse totalitarian system. So I wish them well, and I hope that they're moving towards sort of, what do you call it? Not westernization, but...
Democratic government?
Yeah, just sort of a more democratic, more capitalistic, normal government. More democratic instead of more totalitarian. But like I said, it's sort of in the air right now. We don't know what's going on.
Well, who knows? They might be fighting and they're going to keep in Sharia law and all sort of crap.
Here's the thing, though. It's all good and all that. They want to live a better life. And, you know, yeah, it's horrible. People have to cover their faces. some women can't drive cars. But like I said, these people saw the aid that Libya got, and it's almost like they just, there's like the people in Syria, it's like they're still waiting for an outside intervention. These people in Syria, they're not going full force against the Syrian army. They just keep getting shot, and they just keep getting killed. It's like, are they waiting for us to step in? Because we're not going to.
Have they asked for our help? Like, have they said America
help
us?
I don't know, but obviously not. That would have been all over the news.
I was going to say, because, yeah, Obama would have been all over that. Oh my God, Middle Eastern people need our help.
I'm a bit dubious about that, because it's not so much that they are... Well, the thing is, I don't know if that they're expecting help from us, saying, okay, well, they helped Libya, they went to war with all these other countries.
Why would we help them? That's the thing.
Well, the thing is how is this perceived in the region? Is it perceived as, oh, the Americans are coming to help us and do all this, or is it perceived as, well, you know, from the other countries that are like Syria, or do the Syrians perceive it as, oh, the Americans are over here dicking around again?
Well, I mean, like, I remember when I was over there in Iraq, they were always really grateful and thankful, but we did a hell of a lot more in Iraq than we did and that we're doing in Libya and Syria and all that. So, I don't know. These guys may think, oh, great, we wanted their help and they took all this out, now they're retaliating harder on us. Thanks, America. Or
I think that's good, though, that, like I said, we bombed the shit out of all the enemy installations and then we just left them. And
you think it's good. What are they going to
do? Well, they realized that it was on them and they took the initiative and they took over Tripoli and all that shit. And, you know, now Gaddafi's reign is down. You know, in Iraq, it almost seems like they're dependent on us. They're dependent on our money.
Yeah. Well, I think I get what you're saying.
What happens when we leave? Because now it's been, what, how long have we been in Iraq? 8 years?
Something like that.
Well, Iraq gets 10. 2001.
That's Afghanistan.
Well, what I'm saying is, you know, Libya, we did our part and then said, all right, guys, you guys are the ones that wanted the revolution. Here you go. You know, Iraq, we went in for different reasons, but, you know, I don't think these guys would be able to do what the Libyans have done.
Yeah, well, with the Libyans, kind of like you said, one of the things that we did for the Libyans is we just sort of leveled the playing field. We took away the Libyan government's air assets for the most part. We took away their anti-air stuff. We basically went through and just wiped out all of their heavy stuff and, you know, cruise missiles and nonsense. And then we just didn't bother with it anymore. And that sent a message to the Libyan rebels that, okay, here we are, we have leveled the playing field. If you want this revolution, go fight what's left of it. And
that's kind of what the French did with us in our revolution, you know? The Brits had the Navy that we didn't have, and the French came in there with their Navy at the end and helped us out. They took away the one thing the Brits had over us. But we fought our own fucking revolution. We won our own freedom. Maybe we're just... I almost hate to use this comparison because I don't like the French, but maybe we're kind of acting like the French in their revolution in this case.
Well, isn't there something in that book you like, Starship Troopers, that says something about something given has no value?
Yes. I thought you didn't read the book. How could you know that passage?
Because it was in the movie, which you don't like.
The movie? Oh my God. Do not get me started on Starship Troopers in the movie.
Well, anyway, yeah. The point stands, though. Something given has no value, to an extent. So, you know, we gave them some support, but they're mostly earning it themselves in Libya, whereas
and
with Iraq,
you know,
came and fought the whole thing for them.
Another thing, you know, like you said, the Libyans are earning it themselves. It's because it almost seems like the entire country united against Gaddafi. But when you got Iraq, you have Sunnis, you have Shiites, and you've got all the Taliban factors, or not Taliban, but all the terrorist factors. So these people, they already hate each other, and we're trying to bring them together to go against one entity. Well, they're already against each other. How are you going to bring two enemies together to fight another enemy?
Right now,
I just don't think it'll work.
From what I saw, right now, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and they'll treat it like that. But once that's gone, they're going to go back to hating each other, and a new guy's going to fight and rise for power and all this crap.
Yeah, there's a really good documentary that followed around some, I don't know if it's a platoon or company, but pretty much all they, like, they, you know, they secured areas and they went on patrols and I guess, I don't know what they call camps, forward operating bases.
FOBs, yeah, forward operating bases.
They would put some FOBs up in southern Iraq, and pretty much what they were doing were just paying off all the town leaders, and, you know, they'd say, all right, guys, here's your $50,000 for the month, and these guys would say, oh, that's not enough. Like, okay.
Well, I think the great thing about Libya is if the rebels are good rebels and not annoying rebels, I think what's great about Libya is when all this is said and done, assuming the rebels win and they install an actual good government, they will get to say, as a point of national pride, we fought a tyrannical government and got rid of it. The Americans helped. Yeah.
Just like we say with the revolution.
Yeah.
French helped.
Now, unfortunately, if you look to some of the other countries, what are the Iraqis going to say? Well, the Americans showed up, got rid of the old government, and trained some forces, and then left.
Well, I mean, it's
great.
Have
but,
them to leave them?
Yeah, well, it's good for them as a country as if it works, but it's sort of like what I'm talking about is a point of national pride where the Libyans will get to say, we fought our revolution, we won our revolution. The Iraqis will get to say, the Americans showed up, kicked out the old government, installed a new one, and then left. Well, they didn't do it themselves.
Well, as you said, they're not going to have that point of pride, but they are still grateful.
Oh, yes, it's a good thing. And they are still grateful, but I think it solidifies it more when the country, you know, sort of rose up as one and said, we're not going to take this crap anymore.
Did you find the Iraqi men to be lazy and not to have any ambition to do anything themselves? Kind of like they're just waiting for...
Well, initially, before I got there, I heard that about a lot of the Iraqi people, but I mainly dealt with the police force, and those guys were actually kind of scary because most of them were cops because revenge-filled motives. You know, someone they knew got killed or terrorists had done this or that to their family and they became cops. And they were out for blood, not justice. But the ones I typically dealt with were stupid and just totally incompetent, but they had spirit and drive. But for the most part, I didn't get to see the Iraqis in their day-to-day life. I didn't get to see where they went to work and stuff like that. But I didn't get that same sense of motivation that you get with a lot of the working class. I do want to stress that, working class Americans.
Yeah, because the reason I asked, like, again, in that documentary, you know, these guys will come into a new village and it'll just be trashed.
And the guys
aren't, you know, they're not, like, yeah, it sucks. An Apache went in there and took out some known terrorists or somebody that was putting an IED. But these guys, you know, they don't even bother cleaning up the trash. There's shit everywhere, dead cows. And I mean, it's like, you know.
Yeah, that was, I saw one of their, quote, sewage systems, and it was moldy, trash, human waste. I mean, it was the most disgusting thing I'd ever seen. And that was right on the outskirts of their village. There are houses right around that.
Do you think they're at a point, though, where they're just like, what's the point?
Yeah, there's some point. I mean, there's trash everywhere. And I don't see these guys ever wanting to clean them up.
And I don't mean what's the point is it. It'll take too long. But it's like, you know, maybe they feel like, why rebuild right now? Because for all we know, tomorrow, a hellfire might hit the wall.
Well, no, that they don't have that. It's a lot of them is that's just they just grew up with. That's all they know. They don't know any different. But
you know, Iraq was a pretty modern city
and country.
I'm sorry, it was a pretty modern country, and I imagine that all these outskirt villages were, you know, they were nice.
Baghdad,
adobes and all that, and pretty clean. I can't.
Baghdad is very Western. Baghdad is very modern and very clean. I mean, women there walk and dress like women do in the States or in Europe. I mean, I saw McDonald's and malls and grass. I mean, they planted grass out there.
I think what they're waiting for is for either the Americans to leave, and then I think either the country will rebuild. It's, you know, they'll start the rebuilding process, or they're never going to do it. They're just going to continue fighting.
Well, part of it could be in these times, the Middle East is starting to see itself a little bit differently than it has been over the last couple of decades. And you saw the same thing in the Soviet Union towards the end, and you're actually seeing the same thing in Europe right now, where they're getting to that point where they're kind of looking for their place in the world. And you end up in a position of people sort of wondering what they're supposed to be and what they're supposed to be doing. And it leads to this kind of hopelessness where it's like, okay, we're not the leaders in the world. We're just here.
Seems like there's a lot of uncertainty, and that could contribute to that point I was making. You know, the guy's not doing anything.
Anyway, there's the music, so it's time to end this episode. And what a horribly depressing episode it was, but hey, we had fun doing it. Mixing business with Go. That's tonight's episode of Afterburn, brought to you by the Apple IIe. Oregon Trail never looked so good.
Omega Watch is the first anime watch for our movie, also won by Tim Craig.
And Pilots, looking down on people since 1903.
And thanks for tuning in to Afterburn. Make sure to like us on Facebook and like us in person, because we like that sort of thing. So I wish I was James Bond, just for the day. Kissing all the girls, blow the bad guys away. And I wish I was James Bond, just for the day. Kissing all the girls, blow the bad guys away.
I've been expecting you. Martini in your hand and that eyebrow that you move. Don't take this the wrong way. I know it might sound odd. I'm the next 00. I'm the right man for the job. So I wish I was James Bond, just for the day.